or society around him, and they are trying to keep this, you know, this treasure trove open, you know, the international aid and donors money and so forth and so on. So they have this economic structure that is working really well for them, and they are getting richer and richer by the day. And then you have this superstructure around it that trying desperately to sell to the Palestinian people that we're not doing this for our own sake. We are doing it so that Palestine would become a free country. And look, this country is about to recognize us. So they use this recognition kind of to tie all of this back to the original point you raised. They are trying to use all of these promises of recognitions or the recognitions of a symbolic Palestinian state to build a superstructure to tell their people, we're not wasting time here. We're not just getting rich at your expense and we're not offering anything. You know, those Hamas people, they are resisting using arms. And look what Israel has done to them. But us, on the other hand, we are the ones who are achieving the real deal. Symbolic, you know, these recognitions of Palestine. Palestinians are not buying into it. The vast majority of Palestinians are pro-resistance. In fact, Palestinians in the West Bank are more pro-resistance than people in Gaza. And I presume because of what the people in Gaza are going through.
Pro-militant resistance?
Yes, absolutely. Pro-armed struggle. This has been going on for a long time. It's not a new phenomenon. That it doesn't mean that they are pro-Hamas or pro-Islamic Jihad or pro socialist or no, it's just pro the fact that al-Muqawama Palestinians right to use any forms of resistance to fight against Israel. So this has been going on for a long time. The reason that the Arab regimes don't like Hamas, it's not because of Hamas itself. Because Hamas does not really operate in Saudi Arabia. Hamas has very little influence on political outcomes in Egypt. The reason that they loathe Hamas, as you put it, is because Hamas is kind of the final or the last functioning unit of, in their mind, whether this is historically correct or not, it's a different story. But in their mind, Hamas is the last functioning unit of the Muslim Brotherhood in the region that is actually able to push back, that is able to kind of captivate Arab masses, that is still pushing the idea that overthrowing these undemocratic, unelected, corrupt, oppressive Arab regimes is a possibility. So for them, in fact, I don't know if you've read the book War that was written by the historians of the White House, the person who's usually writes the biographies or the kind of the legacies of various US presidents. He talks about the minutes of Anthony Blinken's meetings in with various Arab rulers and regimes in the first visit he paid to the Middle East after the genocide. And he talks about how there was consensus among Arabs. Yeah, fine, take Hamas out. The only country which is odd enough was the United Arab Emirates that said, you know, these images of massacres are not really helping Israel's image in our region, you know. So if you want this normalization thing to continue, you might want to ease it up on the massacres, you know, taking place in Gaza. But in essence, they all did not have a problem with Israel eliminating Hamas. And this is a position that is really consistent with their media coverage. I mean, we read Arabic media every day, and we know what Al-Arabiya, what are, you know, the Emirati media, what pan-Arab media, aside from Al Jazeera and a couple of other exceptions, the way that they promote, you know, kind of talk about what's happening in Gaza. Because if the resistance, all the resistance, socialist, Islamists, or any others, managed to score any kind of win. And a win for the resistance simply means preventing Israel from achieving any of its strategic objectives. And they are able to promote that as a win within the Middle East. There is going to be some serious rethink in the region. And this is why the fear of Hamas. It's not Hamas because of Hamas's, you know, political objectives. It doesn't matter to Israel, to the Arabs, you know, like what harm will a Palestinian state do to the Arabs? It's not that. It's not the politics of Palestine, but the politics of the region that is creating a problem for the Arabs. And this is why, right now, what they are trying to push for is an agreement, a proposal that would allow Israel to end the genocide in Gaza, take its captives back, food and supplies to be allowed into the Strip, but at the same time for Hamas to drop its weapons. I think for the Arabs, this would be the perfect scenario, because then they don't have to contend with the idea that if, you know, Hamas's victory, if you will, over Israel in Gaza, because it's going to bring some, you know, kind of old discussions back to the political discourse in the Middle East and the need to overthrow these regimes and so on.
Because I've thought about this for years, and I don't suppose I really have the right to think about these things, that there is no Palestinian leadership. There's no national liberation movement. The PLO used to be a national liberation movement, but there is no longer any Palestinian national liberation movement. This may be really presumptuous for me to say, and there's with a strategy and leadership, but I have come to the conclusion that Palestinian people do have a national liberation movement, and it's called Hamas. That Hamas, like if it exists, that Hamas is that national liberation movement. They've got a vision, they've got a strategy, they've engaged in tactics, but Abbas and Hussein al-Sheikh, they're totally silent. We hear nothing from them. They go around hobnobbing at the United Nations. The Palestinians have a fabulous, talented diplomatic corps, but they're not enunciating anything that's very exciting. Whereas, you know, Hamas, listening to their political leaders in Doha, they're talking serious, serious stuff.
Absolutely, and I agree with you. I think there is a Palestinian national movement. I mean, or liberation movement, rather. And I mean, if you just look at when Israel started this war, they had something like 2,150 Merkava tanks, and they said 1,700 was operational, and the rest were in the process of being repaired. Well, I mean, we look at the various numbers, and even the most modest of these numbers says at least half of them are gone. Now, this is more than all Arab countries have achieved fighting Israel over the course of decades, right? So not only this national liberation movement exists, but it's actually able to make the kind of difference that no other form of Palestinian national movements have done in the past. But that still there is an issue here. Because for that Palestinian national movement to truly deserve the name of being representative of a nation, it needs to break away from the boundaries of Gaza into the rest of Palestine. And the Palestinian Authority knows that very well. That's therefore they are cracking down on any attempt to reignite a Palestinian national movement or liberation movement in the West Bank that is consistent and works together hand in hand with those in Gaza. So there is the severance or the attempt to sever any ties between the West Bank and Gaza is out of the fear that the Palestinian liberation movement will become indeed national. That's one component. The second component is that the Palestinians are being disoriented right now. I mean, we talk about the achievements of the Palestinians and the resilience of the people and the incredible sacrifices, but we cannot deny that we are as a nation being disoriented. I mean, there is, you know, there are some of our people out there who are fighting and dying for what they believe, and others are collaborating with the enemy. The Palestinian national discourse is being prevented from making it to, you know, kind of globally, unlike the times of the PLO. I mean, I am in Italy, I've done a lot of study about a certain generation of pro-Palestinian leftists in Italy that was educated at the hands of Palestinian intellectuals from the left in the 60s and 70s. We had a global dimension to our movement. And now we are in the process of doing so. Hamas would have, I don't want to say Hamas would need to change its discourse. I don't have the right to do so, but the Palestinian liberation movement, whether Hamas or the Jihad or the socialists or any others, they have to work towards a global discourse. Not to compromise any of their beliefs whatsoever. because the Palestinian liberation discourse right now is not rhetoric, is the outcome of lived experiences. So it would be insane for them to try to alter the discourse that is an outcome of lived experiences, and those lived experiences include genocide and famine. But they also need to work towards articulating a discourse that is globally appealing, that someone in Norway or in Cuba can relate to it. And I feel like, yes, we are in the process of developing an unprecedentedly strong Palestinian liberation movement. We're not there yet. We're not there yet. And I think the moment we are going to be there, I think we are going to be in our strongest we'll have the strongest global appeals that we have never succeeded of achieving in the past, partly because of the power of the Palestinian resistance, but also partly because of the horrendous nature of the Israeli extermination and genocide, which is now seen everywhere. I mean, David, you wouldn't believe, like, I know you travel, but I travel so much from the global north to the global south, and I see Palestine everywhere. Palestine is everywhere.
I see Palestine, little Free Palestine stickers on lamp posts here in North Brabant, in Breda.
Imagine, but even some communities, like in Italy, especially in the south, they are becoming more sophisticated than Free Palestine or Stop the Genocide into advocating the release of specific prisoners, you know, or putting posters of the likes of Khaled Jarrar in the streets of Napoli. I mean, I haven't seen anything like this in the past. So this is, you know, back to the issue of discourse. The Palestinian discourse is no longer a sentimental discourse, free Tibet, free Palestine, free Ukraine sort of thing, into something far more entrenched in the minds of ordinary people and civil societies around the world. And we Palestinians must capitalize on that by presenting a unified Palestinian discourse. Not leadership, that's a whole different question, but a unified Palestinian discourse.
Well, leadership doesn't need to be, and it probably would be best not to be just composed of senior apparatchiks and politicians. We're talking about intellectuals, public intellectuals, professionals, you know, people who engage in politics at the grassroots. And I think of a guy like Mahmoud Khalil in the United States, who, you know, I think of him. I think this is a future Palestinian leader. I mean, he is a Palestinian leader, except in the United States, fighting to stay in the United States. And there are countless others. I mean, you are one of them. And there's many of them living in the diaspora around the world, Palestinians who've been living in Canada or the United States or in Latin America for generations, and they're young people, and in Europe. And I'm wondering, what would it take for this community? What would it take for this community to coalesce, to form something that could actually mount an attempt to get Abbas and Hussein al-Sheikh out and reestablish governance within Palestine, perhaps after the genocide, whenever that happens?
And it will happen. It will happen. I was debating a Palestinian Authority ambassador somewhere in Europe. I think there was a Freudian slip there in the conversation. No need to name names. I have enough legal problems to deal with. But he said something when I was saying that it is time for you to move on and lead this new generation that is the outcome of this new reality imposed on the Palestinians, those who are in the trenches, those who are fighting the good fight, those who are not just in Gaza and the West Bank, but globally as well, to take over. And he was personally offended by that. And he said, well, let's just see what Israel can do in Gaza. Meaning, let's see if Israel can actually finish off the Palestinians. And I was just so outrageous, like I almost just left the studio. Just the fact that he would actually is still hoping that Israel might be able to manage the situation, so we don't have to deal with the scenario of these young people taking over. When I used to tour, and you know, with books and conferences and stuff about Palestine, when I was in my late 20s and early 30s, I used to always, and I don't want to say I coined the term, but I definitely pushed that term of reclaiming the Palestinian narrative. Now people are referring to as centering Palestinian voices. And I say, no, you have to go further than that. Talk about centering truly representative and authentic Palestinian voices. Because Hussein al-Sheikh is a Palestinian voice. I don't need him centered right now. So only those who are truly representative of the Palestinian experience should be centered. But now, when I travel and speak, this I don't even see the need sometimes, because the number of the Palestinians involved in shaping the discourses in various communities around the world is so overwhelming that I don't need to go and complain about Palestinians being marginalized in their own discourse anymore. So this is something extremely pleasant for me to see and hear these young people taking over, and they are speaking the right language, and they are connected to the aspirations of their people in Gaza, and they are not scared, and they are willing to go to prison, they are willing to go to trials, they are willing to lose their jobs, or even lose being kicked out of universities, as hundreds of them have been kicked out of American universities, but they will not alter their position. So there is a generation in Gaza, in the West Bank, and globally in diaspora, which in Arabic we call the Shatat. And these people are ready to take on the new Palestinian discourse. But remember what our friend Antonio Gramsci has said when he spoke about the times that the age of monsters, where the old refuses to die and the young is yet to be born. And I think we are living in this age of monsters. But I do believe that the young will eventually be born. And all of these names, all of these characters that you hear about, the Palestinian Authority, Abbas, Sheikh, all of them are at one point are going to become a thing of the past. And we will even forget their names altogether.
But to put a fine point on this, Ramzi Baroud, getting to the end of our conversation, are there attempts or plans to actually bring Palestinians together from across around the world, grassroots intellectuals, political thinkers, in a, I mean, something concrete like a national conference in Paris or in Istanbul or someplace where people can actually gather together, like to heck with this, United Nations gathering sponsored by the French and the Saudis, where people signed on to a declaration. I mean, what does that mean? Are there plans to hold a national global conference of Palestinians who would come up with a platform?
I think personally, it's too early now, even though there have been some attempts in various, from Istanbul to Madrid. But the question is, in order for us to formulate a unified position, and I do think that in essence that unified position exists, conceptually it exists, to bring it together in the form of a political forum that would allow us to say these Palestinians representing these entities, hold this belief. I think for us to do so, the genocide would have to stop in Gaza. The new Palestinian leadership emerging from Gaza as a result of this genocide would have to articulate a discourse, and we globally have to respond to it. But I don't think that we have the right to impose or to initiate that discourse if those in Gaza, who are still have not, gathered the mutilated bodies of their loved ones, they are the ones who started this. They are the ones who are bearing the brunt of it. They are the ones who are paying the price for it. And I don't think it would be ethical for us to leave them behind and formulate a discourse independent from them. Gaza has to start the conversation, and we have to respond to that.
Last question, Ramzi Baroud. It really gets us into an area we've not gotten into, that I think sometimes the fundamental problem, not simply in Palestine, but in the world, is that there is no longer any rule of law, that Israel and the United States, I refer to it as Israel USA, it is a single entity. Israel and the United States are conjoined twins. That Israel USA has shown to the world that the international legal order is dead. There is no international law. And now, of course, we've got, Trump talking with Putin and saying, sure, go ahead and we accept your annexation of Crimea, and we support your annexation of the Donbass and the Europeans are getting all hot and bothered, and they're meeting with Trump today in the White House, and they're saying, no, no, this is a violation of international law. And I say, what international law? There is no international law. Israel annexed East Jerusalem and the Syrian Golan Heights back, you know, 25 years ago. No, 45 years ago. And the world accepts it. So there is no rule of law. So how, in a world where there is no rule of law, the UN Charter is just empty, how can you actually achieve national liberation for the Palestinian people? It's got to be tethered to international law, doesn't it?
It does. It does. And we're, I mean, I think the genocide would have not carried on for as long as it has if we had a semblance of an international order. I mean, in 1956, when France, Britain, and Israel invaded Egypt, and Israel took over Gaza and parts of Sinai, yes, the U.S. was squarely very much the heart of Western powers and very much on the side of Israel, but still that action seemed to be inconsistent with American agenda in the region, and they put their foot down along with the Russians, the Soviets at the time, and they ordered these countries to leave. The fact that Israel is able to do this and just carry on doing it day after day after day is because we don't have even an, you know, anything that would resemble some sort of an international system that cares about checks and balances. And this is a problem, not just for Gaza. I mean, we are carrying the heavy load of this problem, but it's a problem for everybody. I mean, isn't this why the League of Nations was established after World War I? Isn't this why the United Nations were established after World War II? You know, now we are living in an age in which anything goes. And here's the problem with law. Law, even if it sounds beautiful, I mean, we Palestinians sometimes desperate for the lack of action from the international community are constantly citing international law. UN Resolution 242, 338, 181, 194. But at the end of the day, if there's not, the people who created these laws are not honoring them. And if they honor them in principle, they are not carrying them out. And there's no mechanism to do so. So the Israeli military occupation that's supposed to be a temporary process under the Geneva Convention becomes a permanent process that could go on forever and ever. The genocide happened because of this. Israel would have not been able to do what it's doing in Gaza if there was any form of enforcement of international law in the first place. In some sense, I wonder, we keep blaming Netanyahu and his government and Ben-Gvir and Smotrich and those other extremists for everything that's happening in Gaza. But if you really widen the scope a little bit, you're going to find those who are deserving blame for the genocide in Gaza really include many, many other players. Of course, starting with the United States, most of Western Europe, but many others, including the Arabs, for allowing Israel to do what it's doing to the Palestinians with no accountability whatsoever.
Ramzi Baroud, in 1 minute, can you give a quick plug for your new book?
Well, I actually have two new books coming up. One is Before the Flood with Seven Stories Press, and that can be pre-ordered now. It is basically the story of a single family in Gaza, my family in Gaza, for the last 100 years up to October 7 and the events that followed. I think it's, if anybody wants to understand that what happened in Gaza has a context, well, that book is the context, Before the Flood. The other book is Gaza Rising, and that is an attempt by myself and Professor Ilan Pape to center the voices of Palestinian youth from Gaza, to give them the platform to talk about the genocide, their families, their lives, their hopes and dreams, despite of everything that is happening.
Ramzi Baroud is a U.S.-Palestinian journalist and author. He's the editor of Palestine Chronicle, former managing editor of London-based Middle East Eye, and former deputy managing editor of Al Jazeera Online. Ramzi is the author of 6 books, and 2 coming out soon, and a contributor to many others. His last volume, co-edited with British-Israeli author Ilan Pappe, Our Vision for Liberation, Engaged Palestinian Leaders and Intellectuals Speak Out. We'll link to all those things at greenplanetmonitor.net. Ramzi Brood, thank you so much for joining me on the Green Planet Monitor.
Thank you for having me.
It for today's GPM, a listener-supported podcast coming to you from Earth Chronicle Productions in the Netherlands. Listen to, read, and watch more Earth stories at greenplanetmonitor.net. Find us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and YouTube, and our home base, Blueberry. We're also on Canada's Harbinger Media Network. I'm David Kattenberg, over and out for now.
Becomes part of the Macaulay Library. Adding more recordings to the collection helps researchers study patterns in bird songs and improve sound ID tools. Learn more on our website, birdnote.org. I'm Ariana Willis. Support for BirdNote is provided by Marjorie and Ed Yunus from Seattle, Washington, and generous listeners around the world.